and that was Bella Ciao, actually going out to all my Italian relatives and friends, to all the Arnatti family over there in Italy. Thank you for being you. And Bella Ciao, actually, just to give you some background, that was a song from the Italian resistance during and after World War II. And it's, well, what can I say? It's self-explanatory. I won't add to it. I can't add to it. I'm welcoming you all today to this BBS Radio network. Radio Freakin' Out is here every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific. We're here to liberate minds and reclaim our world. We're not just educating, we're arming people with the truth and training them in the common law and in fighting the psychotic killers who are running the world, in a nutshell. You can follow our work, itccs.org, murderbydecree.com. And today we're starting actually a three-part series looking at one aspect of that psychotic rule, the history and reality of disappeared people in Canada and by extension all over the world, a term that the Nazis came up with to describe how they got rid of people and then erased their memory was Nacht und Nebel, which means night and fog. And we're going to look at how night and fog operates in Canada, especially on the West Coast. When we're talking about the disappeared, we're not putting it into the little box that the government is now trying to put it into. A few Native women have somehow disappeared, and now we're going to go look for them. In the same way they said, well, a few Native children were harmed in residential school, and now we're going to give some money and forget about it all, along with our little cute apology. No, this is a much bigger reality. The crime of the disappeared is much bigger and much closer to home than we first realized. And you only get a sense of this when you start working with the people on the ground, as I've done for over 25 years, including as a minister in the downtown part of Vancouver, where I personally began to learn about this stuff long before I even had contact with residential school survivors. Our guest today is Merv Ritchie. Merv is a veteran journalist from Terrace, British Columbia, which is up north, along what's called the Highway of Tears, Highway 16 between Terrace and Smithers, where so many Native women have gone missing. But the story is much bigger than that, and we're going to look into more of that today. Merv will be on in a few minutes. And leading up to that, I want to, again, remind people to go to itccs.org, the Tribunal, International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State website, itccs.org. If you go back to the posting, it's just two back now, it's under September 30th, you'll see there a memorandum that's gone out to governments around the world from the ITCCS, and part of that memo talks about the crimes of genocide in Canada today, the disappeared, entire Aboriginal families that are going missing. Now, two points I just want to emphasize out of this that are very relevant to today's discussion, because Merv, of course, is going to get into not only his evidence, but how he's been targeted for persecution by the police and others in northern British Columbia. Now, the two points in this memo that people have to be aware of is, first of all, there's a continuity of crime. The crimes in the genocide in the residential school area never stopped, and in fact, they're happening at the hands of the same people. The top leadership of the Anglican, Catholic, and United Churches, along with corporate directors and others, are seriously involved in these disappearances. And secondly, the women who have gone missing, when you look at their history, they often come from the traditional clan mother lineage systems, which historically were responsible for defining who would own the land and the resources prior to the Europeans coming. Now, if you want to wipe out any sense of who owned the original title of the land so you can grab that land, you've got to target these people. And in fact, our theory about this, the disappeared, is that in fact they're political assassinations. They're Native women and others who constitute a roadblock to big Chinese, American, and Japanese corporations and Canadian corporations that want the land, the hydroelectricity, the uranium, the oil, all these things that British Columbia especially is important for international conglomerates. So please read that memo. It'll give you some of the background. Now, we also want to look over the next 3 weeks. We're going to be looking at the whole broader issue of the disappeared. And one aspect of that, of course, is the continual, as I mentioned, there's the night aspect, the disappearance of people. And then there's the fog, the way you fog somebody's memory so people forget about them. The media in Canada, the academic world, especially, have been playing a very key role in that by fudging the real history. Now, just closer to home, and we're going to get into this next week in particular, where we'll go into more detail about this, but the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, on the campus, is the Musqueam Indian Reserve, and we have an eyewitness, Les Gurin, who was a maintenance man there, who describes how the Musqueam Reserve and three other spots on the UBC campus are, in fact, body dumping sites. And, in fact, Dave Picton, the brother of the so-called serial killer Willie Picton, was actually employed by the Musqueam Band for 2 years. And he provided, guess what, filler for street construction. He brought out all sorts of bags and soil for that purpose. Now, what's interesting is Les said he saw Dave Picton bringing bags out to the Musqueam Reserve. Les went out and dug up the what he had buried, and it turned out to be all sorts of bones that, when he had them analyzed, they turned out to be pig and human bones. He took that information to the Vancouver police, to all sorts of media. He was not only shut out and told not to look into it, he was threatened, and he eventually had to move away from the Musqueam Reserve. Now, there's a whole other history that we're going to get into, but when you look at what the University of British Columbia Endowment Lands are, they are not part of the City of Vancouver. They're under provincial jurisdiction and RCMP jurisdiction. So if you're looking for a spot to dump bodies, and the RCMP is involved in these disappearances, Human Rights Watch in New York has already said that in an official report, that the RCMP and other police in British Columbia are directly involved in the disappearing and death of Native women. Now, that's the thing you won't hear in the Canadian media, but that was in the Human Rights Watch report out of New York, and we'll be talking about that next week. UBC is an ideal place for body dumping, and we're going to describe that. When you look at even the who's on the Board of Governors at UBC, it's the very multinational corporations that have a vested interest in getting rid of Native people. Stuart Belkin, the chair of the Board of Governors at UBC, a founding director of Timberwest, the largest logging company in the province. The UBC Chancellor, Gordon Lindsay, is a former CEO of, guess what, HSBC Bank, the big the bank that was prosecuted by the U.S. government for laundering money for drug cartels in Mexico. And we know drug laundering and human trafficking and all that go hand in hand. So, you know, this is some of what we're dealing with right in our own backyard. Now, as I mentioned, we're going to get into that next week. That's just kind of a little tease for people just to know that this is going beyond the issues that we'll be talking about today. Now, I believe we have Merv standing by. Yes, we do. So we're going to go to Merv Ritchie right now. Hello, Merv. How are you?
Hello, Kevin. Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you. And, I don't know if it's the kind of holiday we should be mentioning around Native people, but it's also an interesting holiday. 7 years ago tomorrow, I was in Rome performing our first exorcism on the Vatican, so that was kind of fun. And filled with all sorts of interesting outcomes. So, Merv, let me just ask you to give a little intro to yourself about who you are, what you've been involved in, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I can go way back, I guess. I grew up in a very high-class, upper-class family, a very kind of spoiled upbringing. And in my younger years, I walked away from that and moved out into the bush and lived on the streets for a little bit. And ended up working in mines, but I didn't like working in living in the mine camps. So I moved out into the bush first in got a tarp to build myself a lean-to, then a pup tent, building a wall tent, and somebody told me I should get a teepee. So for the next 5 years, I learned how to live in the bush in the mountains in a teepee.
Was that up north? Was that in northern BC?
That was in southeast BC. I worked for Fording Coal. As a heavy-duty mechanic. But then I moved up to Tumbler Ridge, northeast B.C., from southeast to northeast B.C. I lived all over the place. I attended powwows and thought I knew a little bit about Indigenous life until I moved to Terrace in 2006.
Okay, good.
And I discovered what's known as Temlaham or Demalahamet. It's the territories of the Nishka, the Gitxsan, the Tsimshian, Wet'suwet'en, Haisla, Haida, all the northwest indigenous tribes all come from one core beginning that they tell all the stories from. I was astounded. I realized that I, at that point, really knew nothing about the indigenous life. So what brought me up there was a newspaper enterprise. And I was asked to set up a newsprint press, and then I was asked to run the press. So I ran the press, and then I needed more stories, so I started covering the city council and the regional district meetings, and realized that I had to learn all about these different nations that I lived in. Terrace is in the center of the Tsimshian nation. Kitsum-Kalem and Kitsilas are the two federally appointed band councils that claim their territories there. But from 2006 onward to, 2012-13, I became intimately involved with all of them. And I heard all sorts of stories about the RCMP taking and abusing. I witnessed it. I watched the beatings. I watched them chasing people down. I reported on it for years. So that's my background, comes from an upper white class, background, and I involved myself in the indigenous issues quite right. intimately.
Now, the Terrace Daily News, did you actually set up that publication? And tell me about some of the things that it covered that got you in hot water, especially with the Mounties.
Well, yeah, I ended up setting up the Terrace Daily. We had my brother was a publisher and editor for one of Conrad Black's paper, the Prince Rupert Daily News, for years, and then he set up his own newspaper, which he got me involved in. That's how I got into the media business, from being a mechanic. Because I came at it without any training, came at it cold from just a pure, really as a blue-collar life after I left home, I wrote factually. I wrote exactly what I saw. I went and did cold interviews and named names and immediately got myself in hot water with the business community because I was naming how the Chamber of Commerce was being corrupt, how the city executives, in Terrace, the chief executive officer or administrative officer, Poole, would be bold-faced lying to the city councilors. And so I would write that. He'd go back and repeat the same lie to the regional district. And so I'd write that. And I know the Chamber of Commerce president would be making, erroneous statements, and I'd call him out to the carpet. And so, of course, I became incredibly popular. And basically took over all the media. When we started our website, no one else was in Terrace was doing a news website. Their standard Black Press rag. Black Press owns most of the newspapers in BC. That's why most people
right.
don't get good news. But they updated their website once a week. Well, we updated our website hourly, and it was a fluke. But in 2007, there was a major flood in Terrace. And, of course, we were posting pictures and updates hourly. So people came to our website. And so we basically took over the media with our provocative coverage and our current coverage.
Now, I want to get into, because the theme of the show is about the missing women and others, but I do want you to mention to people how your publication got closed down.
Well, many entities, and I'm not exactly sure who was cooperating with who. But we were hacked. Our servers, we had our own private servers, and they were taken down twice, about a year apart from each other. I'd followed the clues that the director of CSIS left when he was interviewed by Peter Mansbridge, Richard Fadden, the director of CSIS, and he talked about the infiltration of Crown Ministries by foreign government agents, and Peter Mansbridge suggested, was it the China or India? And Richard Fadden wouldn't acknowledge. So knowing what I've been reporting on, the way China was taking all our raw log exports and they were going after all our raw energy, I went directly to the Ministry of Forests site, their political site, Pat Bell's ministry, and found that the exact description that Richard Fadden was talking about, foreign operatives taking senior positions and traveling back and forth to China, was fit exactly the bill. The most senior policy analysts in both the Ministry of Forests and the Ministry of Energy, Mines, and Resources, Bill Bennett's ministry, were Chinese. They were born in China, And now, not to say that they were spies working on behalf of China, but that's what Richard Fadden laid out. They went
all
to
right.
school here in BC. So was it China that took down my servers, or was it the BC government that took down our servers? But anyways, we rebuilt our servers. We got back online. It cost us thousands of dollars. And then after the Human Rights Watch report came out talking about the RCMP being behind the missing and murdered women, and after the last provincial election where our Skeena MLA, the Liberal MLA, lost by just a few votes to the NDP, the Knights of Columbus went to... Now, the Knights of Columbus, many people don't know this, but they're the Catholic Boys Club. They're like little Jesuits. Little operatives. They work in the chambers of commerce, rotary clubs, and, you know, they pay attention to everything that's going on in their communities. But they work for the Catholics specifically. They take directions from the Catholics. They are Catholic. That's the Knights of Columbus. And they went to every one of my advertisers, bar none, and ordered them to stop advertising. I got a call from Hawk Air, who was, you know, the prime airline up in Terrace. They'd just given me the day before a brand new ad to put up. They've been advertising with us for, I don't know, maybe 8 years. And I got a call saying, you got to pull their ad right now, right now. The woman's voice was shaking. So I just got a call from the Catholics. And that was the first one. The next one was Sight and Sound. They were approached three times because they didn't pull their ad down right away. The Chrysler dealership. Knights of Columbus fellow went in there and said, if you don't pull your ad, you won't see our face in here again. It just went on and on. I lost, and then I got evicted from my home. I got a eviction notice, and I had to move out because the fellow was associated with the Catholic Church. So they exerted their power and shut us down completely.
Now, I know you said you had written something critical of the election of the Pope or something, but do you think it was related just to that or other stuff?
Well, you know, was it? I was very provocative in that writing. The Pope had not been elected yet. We didn't know. But because I'm such a news hound and I watch everything, for weeks there is nothing but we are electing our new Pope. And when will we elect, you know, when will they select our new Pope? And this was on CNN's, you know, even Al Jazeera. Everything was our new Pope. We are selecting our new, and I was absolutely furious. And so I wrote this article, was blunt, says we will never have a new Pope. And, you know, the Catholics will have a new leader for their cult, but we won't have a new Pope. The Catholics will have a new leader. And when, of course, I got called out on the word cult. But really, you know, that's if it's not your dogma, then it's a cult. If it's your dogma, it's not a cult.
Right.
That's basically the way it is. And so I in an argument, you know, in the comments section on that article, we will never have a new Pope, I quoted, I went to all my dictionaries. I've got a stack of dictionaries that go back to the 20s. And I just copied all the dictionary definitions of what a cult is. And I listed them all. This is exactly what it is. You know, following any religious dogma.
Right.
It's just that we use the word cult now to be to demonize somebody's belief. That's all. And really, that's what the Catholic is. I mean, they practice things that aren't Christian, that's for certain.
Well, and in terms of the disappearances of people, of course, the Roman Catholic Church led that whole thing, not just in the residential schools, but they've been accounting for the deaths of millions of people at their hands. So, I mean, naturally, anybody who raises the question of people who go missing are going to get the ire up of those who are responsible. So tell me how this relates to your understanding of what's been going on with the whole missing women investigation and that. I know you have more specific information on that.
Well, when the Human Rights Watch report, and I believe you mentioned that earlier, when that report came out, the Human Rights Watch report came out, I was incredibly pleased because it was about time. And I wrote a very provocative headline, "A Welcome to Terrorists, the Hotbed of RCMP Terrorists." Now, that was in 2013. You know, they, post-media, not post-media, it was came out by Canadian Press. Their headline was "Mounties Raped, Abused BC Aboriginal Girls," writes Watchdog Alleges in Report. And I wrote, it's about effing time a national newspaper chain is finally reporting on what we have been stating for years. And you know, when that came out, I was critiqued again for publishing at the RCMP, pulled press releases from me. They told me that our publication was no longer a credible media. The attacks against us for publishing what's been going on just kind of went on and on. And just recently, I discovered, I was tipped off by family that there was a court case going on that involved over a dozen criminal charges against a former RCMP officer. He was a veteran RCMP officer. I guess from what I understand, it was 25 years of service in the RCMP. And it was covered under a publication ban, so I can't talk about it. I've already been criminally charged for breaching the publication ban, so I have to be very careful what I say. But I can say that, you know, this individual had been working up in the North District, and my question is always, well, who were his partners? And if this fella, one individual, is facing numerous charges, and they include rape, abduction, unlawful confinement, attempted murder, if he's got away with this, well, who are his partners? And why isn't anybody else talking about it? And it is under a publication ban, but... And I will say this, I don't know what type of trouble I'll get into, but I know the families. I know the people involved. We're all, I've been there long enough. I've lived with the families. I am very close. So the individual, one of the individuals that made this complaint, let me back up. All people that are involved in this type of an investigation, have RCMP handlers. When somebody's being charged with a crime and you're the complainant, they make sure that you attend trial on time. They make sure you're protected and that you're prepared for trial. You know, that you always have to have somebody. And not all RCMP are bad. They do good things. But this one particular officer who was handling this case advised the complainant that a publication ban was needed because her life was in danger. Her relatives were threatening to kill her. And so when I'm talking to her, I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like, what relatives? Because I know all the relatives. She says, well, I don't know. They're out in this community. She named the community. I better be a little bit careful. But, I don't know, but that's what he said.
So he was trying to get her to agree to a publication ban on her own trial?
Right, and so then when they went to get it, of course, they had advised the court that she lived a high-risk lifestyle, whether it be a drug addict or whatever, but that, if this became public, arguing to the court that, she might harm herself or commit suicide, that's the inference that they would be making to the court,
to get her to acknowledge that they
threatened her life.
Can you tell, in terms of talking around something that might get you thrown in jail, can you say what judge ordered the publication ban?
Robert Punnett.
Punnett?
Punnett, yeah.
Justice now, Punnett, this yeah. Judge Punnett, like, has he had any kind of history of harassing you or blocking any things you're trying to publish or anything?
No, but I have published things about his rulings. I covered a large Heisler trial. The elected... band council sued the hereditary chiefs for slander because they had accused the hereditary chiefs, Chief Jesse Tommy Robinson, he's passed on now, Hamas Wakas, he's the only hereditary elder of the group that were sued still alive, Johnny Wilson, Grant, they had sued the band council because Steve Wilson, who was the elected chief counselor, had made a secret deal with Gordon Campbell, our former premier, to hand over her hereditary chiefs as long as they could get their if they could get the hereditary chiefs to stand out of the way for the BCUC hearings, the BC Utilities Commission hearings, when the Rio Tinto Alcan wanted to sell power to BC Hydro. So the deal was that Steve Wilson would hand over the hereditary chiefs, and then he would get his own hydroelectric plant in exchange. And that letter was exposed in the media. I think Robin Austin exposed it in the BC legislature. Anyway, then the hereditary chiefs held the Hylas Hamas a court in their own traditions. And, of course, the counselors never showed up. But they then charged the hereditary chiefs with slander, and Punnett was the judge in the case. And it's too far, too much to go into, but I'll say this. It was a year and a half after all the final arguments were heard. The trial went on for years. It covered lots. But it was a year and a half when he finally issued his ruling and found in favor of the band counselors against the hereditary chiefs. In his ruling, he used a precedent that wasn't even available when the final arguments were given. It was a year after trial had concluded that this precedent was set that he used to make his judgment. So a lawyer couldn't have even made an argument against it.
Well, you know,
it hadn't even...
So let me just clarify this. The same judge who helped ruled in favor of a band counselor who was trying to sell out the power of his own people to the BC government through a secret deal, that same judge has issued a publication ban on the reporting of this Mountie who stood trial for harming women. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Now he's, I think the first time, this trial, from what I understand, has been going on for quite some time, and the publication ban might have been initiated by another judge, but I know that it's been followed up and reinforced by Punnett on more than one occasion.
So is it your belief that is this kind of Mountie, who's either still facing or is already being convicted for all we know, is he being set up as like another Willie Picton, as a fall guy for something? What's your theory about this whole thing?
Well, I know we've talked about this before, and my theory is no. My theory is that, well, maybe. If it actually does ever become public, then yes. But they're doing everything to keep it quiet. And then coming after me with all guns blazing.
We'll talk about that.
I mean, they took out what they call an MLAT. It's an international treaty that's really used for terrorism. It's called the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. So now they get all my IP address information, all my access to virtually anything digital online, so they can read everything. I'm sure
MLAT.
You know that, Kevin, our emails have been read.
What is it exactly?
Well, it's an international treaty that law enforcement officers can use they make an application that somebody's done something nefarious and we need to get all his internet data. So that's what they've done. The only thing I did was take a screenshot of the court registry, the provincial government's own website, their court registry site, of all the charges against this one individual, post it online on my website and on my Facebook page, and then pose the question. I was in Vancouver at the time, so I posed the question, is this so-and-so? And I had a pretty good idea because it was a relative who called me and, said, this, should be publicized. I just gone out of back surgery, so maybe, I'd like to use the excuse I wasn't thinking quite clearly. But that's all I did was publish what they'd already published. on their own. And they.
And then what happened to you after that?
Well, I was arrested. Taken, you know, as soon as they located me, I was in Vancouver. I'm sure they would have arrested me if I was still up in Terrace earlier, but I got pulled over for just a regular roadside check, and they ran my name and put me in handcuffs and took me to jail and gave me a promise to appear promise to appear, and which I did, of course. And then recently, of course, they've rearrested me because at the same date and time that I was to appear in court, I was also supposed to appear at the community corrections office. That's kind of like where people go for a bail or to see their probation officer or something. And I believe I went in there. I'm trying to recall, but they didn't have anything on me. They just couldn't figure out, you know. But anyway, just 2 weeks ago, I was picked up and taken to the Vancouver City jails because.
And that just happened
way back.
That happened to occur when Prince Andrew and Princess Kate were in town, I believe, eh?
Yeah, the Will and Kate show, I was at the Kitsilano Coast Guard base with my campaign bus to promote the Standing Up for Indigenous Rights. And then they ran my name and hauled me off there.
So what do you face now? When do you have to be in court again? What are they doing to you exactly?
Well, I have to appear again. The 25th, I have to be back and appear in court and explain why I, you know, it's like, you know, it's kind of insignificant. I mean, I could plead guilty and pay a small fine, and I'd be fine, but I have never been arrested for anything. I've never been charged with anything. I've had a clean record all my life. I'm quite proud that I can travel anywhere in the world. And now, if I plead guilty, that makes me a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not prepared to plead guilty, and I don't care if it's only a small fine. This last one, if I pay them $300 and plead guilty, you know, that walks away. The earlier one is a much more significant fine, but you know it's the principle too. I mean, it seems quite absurd that the RCMP are getting away with a publication ban by threatening the life of an Indigenous woman. Say, you need to get this publication ban, or else your life's in danger. Of course, she's scared.
Yep.
You know, and so I think that that's wrong. They lied to the court, you know, and they lied to the woman. And if, in fact, her life was endangered by her relatives, then that's what the RCMP have an obligation to do, is to go investigate that, not to get a publication ban to protect one of their own. And that's what this is all about. And, you know, there's an old saying, I don't know, it's quoted by Mark Twain or whatever, but it's not what we know, or it's not what we don't know that gets us into trouble. It's what we know for sure. That just
yep.
ain't so. You know,
he also had a good
we
one.
We know these things.
Mark Twain also said, a lie can go halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes.
Well, yeah, and it's terrible what I see going on. And what I've witnessed,
yep.
I mean, I have numerous RCMP officers as very good friends. And, you know, one of them really wanted to transfer out of the North Detachment that he was at because he did not like the attitude, did not like what he was living with. And I recognize that in some of the officers. Many listeners might know about Robert Wright, who was beat up by Brian Heideman, left brain damaged. They used the Terrace Daily News, website.
Brian Heideman was a Mountie, was he?
Yeah, he was a Mountie who, you know, the guy, he slammed his, there's a video on it, you know, it's slammed his head into the concrete and left the guy brain damaged. You know, he thinks he's still going to work. I can go and interview him at the home now, and he thinks he's going to work tomorrow.
Yeah.
His cognitive memory's gone, and that's Brian Heideman did that, and they used our news service because Heideman was written up in the small town justice report by the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, the BCCLA, as, you know, as tormenting the indigenous people. We have a long history of this up in Terrace, and that's what I've been covering, and that's why I'm being so singly targeted. And they really do want to shut me up, and I don't blame them. I mean, nobody wants that negative publicity.
Of course, the mature thing to do, which we keep telling the government and churches of Canada, is just take responsibility when you've done it wrong, instead of trying to shut up the people who know the truth.
Well, you know, it's the same thing in many parts of our society, even in unions. You have unions that sanction their members. If somebody's on the job and they start screwing things up, the union will take responsibility and sanction that member. Might even say, you're no longer part of our union. And then there's unions that cover for the jerks that mess things up and take advantage of the company. It's the same thing. It's like the doctors and the lawyers. They're all covering for each other. And the RCMP they cover. If RCMP officers, when they see something wrong, and they would report it and expose it, then it would be a different force altogether. But Brian Heideman, he was one of the ones involved in the steroid use, and he was sharing it with other RCMP in the Terrace detachment. Well, there you go. I mean, these guys are, the illegal activity was within the RCMP already.
Murph, we got about 5 minutes left here. I want you to kind of comment. I want your opinion about when we're talking about missing people in British Columbia. One of the people I worked with for a while, George Browning, was a retired native Mountie in Vancouver, and he was the one who first talked about over 10 years ago entire native families going missing, not just in northern BC, but in downtown Vancouver, and people being targeted. Do you want to, in the next couple of weeks, we want to get into a kind of more detail of what is really behind all these disappearances. What's your belief about what's causing it all?
The ownership of territories, and I can speak primarily about Northwest BC, the ownership of territories belongs to specific matrilines, specific female-led families. If you can destroy the royal bloodline of particular families, they have no claim then to the ancient name that belongs to the territory. In the Delgamuukw trial, that was a Supreme Court trial that was very well exposed with the Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en people. But it's the same with the Nishka and the Tsimshian, the Haisla, the Haida. It's the female line that holds the rights, the legitimacy to the land. And if you can destroy that lineage, they have no more ownership to their land. So it is my belief. The British government, through the Hudson's Bay Company, had full records of what the right lineage was. It is my contention that they targeted those royal families right from the get-go, and the remnants they're trying to pull off now. I started writing about this royal lineage back in 2009, 2008, and Roger Harris, the former Aboriginal representative for the provincial government, Gordon Campbell's government, then I don't know whether he read it or whether he was as clever to follow through as I was, but they're now going to ban councils and getting banned councils to representatives to take the names of these hereditary royal families. And if they can do that and use those names, then they can sign off legitimately on territories that they have no right to hold or own. So if they can destroy the female leadership, the matriline, then they really do have the ability to take all the land.
So you believe that the disappeared, at least a certain number of the disappeared women, are being targeted for that reason?
Oh, I have different thoughts about cleaning up the downtown east side just before Expo 86. I think that they wanted to get rid of anything that looked ugly to the world community. Yes, absolutely. This what's been going on in Northwest BC specifically. The Tsimshian is the greatest nation the greatest indigenous nation on the north coast. So they owned all the waters. You know, the people talk about the Haida. Well, the Haida and the Tsimshian had great battles, but the Tsimshian controlled everything on the coast up. They controlled the outer waters of the Nisga, where Kinkolith is today. That was Tsimshian territory. The Nisga will argue about it, but that was all Tsimshian. You couldn't go out the coast without encountering the Tsimshian nation, and they are targeting them in a most brutal manner. When Gordon Campbell took office, he started the incremental treaty process, which got all the individual bands fighting amongst themselves, Lacalams and Kitsamkalam and Kitsilas. And if you can keep people divided, you win, right? Everybody knows that, divide and conquer. It's a great game. And they've done that to the Tsimshian peoples. And it's you know, they're doing it now to the Gitxsan after the Delgamuukw ruling, the government, what's his name? Denny Vanez, he ran the logging industry. He bankrupted the logging industry deliberately and sold everything off so everybody would be in destitution. And then the government started piecemealing money in through treaty societies. And now you give all the destitute people fighting over the scraps of cash, dividing the Gitxsan people up. The only nation that's still really strong right now is the Wet'suwet'en. You know, and they're united and incredibly strong, and they're, you know, no pipeline is going to crawl across their territory, and you know, we can only see what's going to happen there.
Well, Merv, one other thing about the Tsimshian is that a lot of them were targeted to be carted off to the Edmonton United Church School during the residential school times. The Haida and the Tsimshian were sent over there en masse, sterilized, murdered. We got that all documented. Murdered by decree.
Yes, you know. Kevin, you're being targeted as well. I mean, you know, I had a great conversation with Sean Swanky, who wrote The Great Darkening, The War of Extermination on the Pacific. You know, it's really a seminal work on the smallpox, the deliberate, absolutely without question, deliberate smallpox extermination attempt. But he's made a statement which is quite interesting, that those of us who have seen this, who investigate it, report on it, and write about it, end up going a little bit crazy, you know, because how does your brain function when you realize that all this wealth and benefit and this privilege that we have is based on, you know, the bones of all these people, the ancestors that we killed off, you know, or not we, but you know, our ancestors, you know. It's a tragic history.
Well, white people are living off the avails of genocide. We all profit from it, and nobody wants to look at it, of course.
Well, it's true.
Merv, I want you to come back very soon. We can get into this more. We've only got a few minutes left. I want to play a clip and have a final sign-off, but I want to thank you for today, and I know that more people are going to be rallying behind you after this interview now that they know what you're facing.
Well, I'm hoping I don't get hauled off to jail again. You know, I've seen the inside of two jails now, and it's kind of interesting, but I don't really want to see them again.
Now, you told me you were concerned about being taken off to, was it Prince George?
Oh, yeah. When I'm concerned that when I get back to my hometown of Terrace, that they will make up some charge, and I'll go to the Prince George Remand Center where they hold people, and then somebody's just going to shank me or something because, you know, I can't seem to keep my mouth shut.
You're concerned about your life, in other words.
Well, certainly. Why wouldn't I be? I mean, it's the only way to stop me is with a high velocity piece of lead, really. You know, or some other nefarious means.
Well, look, brother, we're not going to let that happen to any of us. So,
well, you know what I did here, Kevin. Before I go, I started a new political party with two other individuals up north, specifically for this. It's called the Land, Air, Water Party of BC. We want to take the next election, and the acronym Land, Air, Water (LAW) is the law, and it's specifically to stand up for Indigenous rights and to expose these things, but to be honest, truthful, and reasoned. You know,
okay.
We need to have critical thinking skills.
You got a website?
Yeah, thelawparty.ca.
Okay, good.
That's for the Law Party. And, of course,
Merv,
you know, my own, the Terrace Daily is.
Merv, thank you, brother.
Provocative stuff.
Thank you.
All right.
We're going to have you
take
on
care, Kevin. Thanks
soon.
For the call.
Thank you.
Okay, enjoy.
Hey, you too, brother. That's Merv Ritchie, a very brave man and a truthful man. We're going to have him back on soon. I want to play for you before the end of the show two audio clips, one featuring George Brown, that RCMP officer who we'll talk about next week more. involved in the Community Task Force into Missing People that I was part of 10 years ago. Also, Charlotte Stewart, both of them residential school survivors. Charlotte was Simshin, and I'll let them speak for themselves. This is from the, in response to requests from people that they hear more of the testimonies from our common law court case into genocide in Canada, which you can see at itccs.org. For folks who want to listen to all of these audio clips, they're up at www.itccs.org. Top of the page, case number one, the crime of genocide in Canada. There's 3.5 hours of online testimonies, documents, people's, you know, in their own words, describing these crimes in residential schools and how they're connected to what's going on today. And we're going to carry this on for the next 2 weeks. The whole issue of disappeared in Canada, especially on the West Coast, partly in response to this bogus government inquiry that's going on right now. And you know, once again, going to the RCMP for help when they are often the ones responsible for these disappearances. Certainly play George Brown because I want you to hear his words. He's a survivor, but also years ago, I worked with him in the Downtown East Side. We documented for the first time how these missing women were actually from the Blue Blood clan mother lineage that Merv talked about a few minutes ago. And it's definitely part of the bigger genocidal agenda to get the lands and resources. So we'll hear these two voices, and then we'll be back after that.
Now, still today, Aboriginal women are being forced to be sterilized by welfare and government workers across Canada. Charlotte Stewart describes what happened to her in 1983 in Vancouver in video exhibit 49.
My name is Charlotte Stewart. I'm from Kitkatla, B.C. I am Simshin Nation. I had a daughter 30 years ago, whose name is Patricia, and she was apprehended. And after she was apprehended while she was a baby, I got pregnant when she was in the foster home. And the ministry found out I was pregnant, and they told me to have an abortion. And after I have the abortion, to have a tubal ligation, so I won't have any more children. I said if I didn't have a tubal ligation, then I would never see my daughter Patricia again.
Who told you that?
A social worker named Sally Heather. She was at a government office in North Vancouver. It was in the summertime, I can't remember what month, I think it was in July, and Patricia was born in 1982, so it would have been about 1983. She was about a year old.
Behind the routine rape and torture was a constant aim of terrorizing and degrading Indian children, often resulting in their deaths. Former RCMP officer George Brown describes his friend's experience of being flogged at a Catholic Indian residential school in British Columbia in Exhibit 68.
He was punished in a residential school where he had 60 lashes on his back from a strap. And he said, you're probably wondering how I know that, George. He said, because the kids had to count out the lashes on his back. And he said, you thought that was bad. He said, my buddy got it 300 times. And he said, the only reason why the sister had quit, he said, is because she was too tired. She couldn't wail anymore. And 2 weeks later, that young boy died.
And we're back. Next week and the week after, we'll be continuing this discussion with more guests about the disappeared. We're going to be looking specifically into crimes in our own backyard. The example of the University of British Columbia, the body dumping site nearby, Les Gurin, one of the eyewitnesses who found the bones, what happened to him, and also the hard evidence of the complicity of academia, the media, and others across Canada in the concealment of these crimes. So I want to thank you all for tuning in again, and as I mentioned earlier in the show, this is tomorrow, the 7th anniversary of when I went to Rome and called down the truth on the Vatican. And it was very interesting, that first exorcism. The next day, not only did a tornado hit the center of Rome, but the first reports of the complicity of Pope Benedict in covering up child abuse and child trafficking in the Catholic Church at first hit the European media that week. So what we do does have an impact, folks, and I want you to never lose hope and faith in that. I want to thank you all for tuning in today. Follow our work at murderbydecree.com, itccs.org. Write to us, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata@gmail.com. And until next week, stay strong and clear. Thank you all.